Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hey there, if you're listening to this and you support us on Patreon, you can hear it via the Patreon page ad-free. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking with singer, songwriter, and guitarist Jason Isbell on the occasion of his new HBO documentary and his album with the 400 Unit. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. But first, some new music from Detroit post-punk band Proto Martyr.
Welcome to the haunted earth. The living afterlife. Where we chose to forget. The years of the hungry now.
That is a little bit of the song Make Way, which opens the sixth album by the post-punk band Proto Martyr, one of Greg's very favorites. Formed in Detroit, Greg, back in 2010. Same four members ever since. Joe Casey on vocals, Greg Ahe on guitar, Alex Leonard, the drummer, and Scott Davidson on bass. Were signed to Domino Records in 2017, a couple of albums ago. For album number six, they went down to Tornillo, Texas, at a ranch, and recorded the record that's appropriately titled Formal Growth in the Desert. What are they giving us this time around? Let's play a track from this album, and we'll come back with our reviews. This is the song For Tomorrow from album number six by Proto Martyr on Sound Opinions. So you
That is For Tomorrow from Proto Martyr's sixth album, Formal Growth in the Desert. That's an interesting title. Okay, they did ostensibly record in a desert, right? But it also talks about an emotional frame of mind. Formal growth, I think that's the key. A lot of Proto Martyr records can seem pretty depressing, maybe. Certainly downcast, certainly a bleaker view of life. This record, I think, has a little bit of a different spin on it. There is light at the end of this proverbial tunnel, and a lot of that has to do with the conditions that Joe Casey's writing about. I mean, first of all, the key themes, the deterioration of Detroit, the deterioration of his mom, who has battled Alzheimer's until her recent death.
The deterioration of the world, thanks to climate change.
The deterioration of the home they're living in. There's a song in here about how about rats infested his mom's house and he eventually had to move out. So those are elements here. You mentioned the cinematic approach, you know, and it's such a cliche to describe an album that way. But, you know, I went back and listened to some of Protomartyr's earlier work, and there's no doubt there was more of a raging, punkish, garagey feel to a lot of that music. They're definitely trying to expand the palette here from a textural standpoint, from a dynamic standpoint. They're adding this pedal steel player who's bringing in some new textures.
Well,
in the
band. They've been touring on tour. They've been joined by Kelly Deal, adding keyboards.
Yeah. And I think Greg Ahey is just a terrific, you know, he's such an underrated guitar player. I think he's he's a master of texture and tone and using space, creating space, and then filling it, you know, with these bursts of amazing guitar playing and then
squalls.
Receding, you know, into the background. Because that rhythm section is outstanding. Alex Leonard's drumming in tandem with Scott Davidson's bass. They do a lot of coloring in this record particularly.
Yeah.
But Casey, you know, the dude is singing on this record. You know, he's not just a sing-speak kind of guy. There's a tenderness in that voice. Well, listen, I'm just thinking about the wordless vocals that usher out something like Let's Tip the Creator. You know? The way he's using the voice as an instrument on that record. The tenderness that comes across in Graft versus Host. He's a lot of songs about mom. A lot, some songs about being married and feeling like, yeah, I can be loved and give love in this world, despite it all. So I do think there's a lot of growth on this record. You know, it's may not be the first place you want to start with, you know, investigating who Protomartyr is, but I think it's another fine record and a very a terrific career.
I got to say, I am overdosed on Joe Casey.
Yeah.
All right? You know, there were 7,843 Marquis Smith Fall albums. I now feel like we've hit that point with Joe Casey. And I don't need to hear the dude saying, "Can you hate yourself and still deserve love?" Mm. Oh, man. Hang it up. Greg, I would have tuned out this record completely if it were not for Greg Ahey. You're absolutely right, a great noise guitarist. And Alex Leonard, this is the drummer's record, man.
Yeah,
you know, I kept getting sucked in. I was resenting Casey for being on the record, distracting me from Alex Leonard. He has this style of rolling drums. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a sort of propulsive rhythmic roll that never stops. If you think of something a million years ago like the Beatles' Rain, it's really inventive. I think he's one of the best drummers in rock today. And then Casey sings on top of it and ruins it for me. I'm just tired of the guy, man. You know, that line in Polycrillic's Kid about hating yourself and deserving love. I'm just like, you know, I know he's been through some stuff. I think he's purged himself. I don't see the light that you're seeing at the end of this tunnel. I just see a long tunnel.
The Lorraine Garden, listen to that song again. You know, he's coming out the other side. I just think it's a beautifully sequenced record, and I disagree. I think Joe Casey's he's a soul singer, man. I'm sorry.
All right. You say so.
Well, two divergent opinions on that Protomartyr record. I love it. So that's what we thought about the latest from that band. And as always, we want to hear from you. Leave us a voice message with your thoughts on our website, soundopinions.org. Coming up, our conversation with Jason Isbell on Sound Opinions. Did you ever love a woman with a death wish?
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. And we are back. This week, we have the pleasure of talking with singer, songwriter, and guitarist Jason Isbell. We have been fans of his music for years, starting with his tenure with another of our favorite bands, the Drive-By Truckers. Since leaving that group, he's gotten sober. He's released 9 albums, many of which are with his band, the 400 Unit. He also married singer, songwriter, and poet Amanda Shires, and they have a beautiful young daughter.
His latest album, Weather Vanes, came out June 9th, and he was also the subject of the recent HBO documentary, Running With Our Eyes Closed. He's also acted alongside Leonardo DiCaprio in Martin Scorsese's upcoming film, Killers of the Flower Moon. Jason, welcome back to Sound Opinions.
Thank you, guys. I'm always really happy to talk to you guys.
You are a Patreon supporter of our show. What a kind and wonderful man. And now that doesn't sway us from loving Weather Vanes. We'd love it even if you weren't.
Thank you, but I do think, yeah, we have to let people know. We have to full exposure here. I love the show and support the show.
Thank you.
So it's not a you scratch my back, I'll scratch your sort of situation, though. I fully expect one day I will be eviscerated by you gentlemen.
But in a kind way. You know, Greg always says, Jason, if you're going to give a negative review, you know, it should be that we would read it to your face.
Yeah.
Not gratuitously, maybe.
Of course. Yeah. I think that's fair. And I think it's a job that's necessary because those of us who know who to listen to pay attention to those people. You can't go through it just without any sort of guidance, try to wade into the morass of all the music that's out there. So it's important to have some places that you look to.
Wow, that's really nice of you to say, man.
It is.
I feel validated. 40 years not completely wasted.
Yeah, we've been doing something.
Listen, you got a lot on the plate here because between the documentary, Running With Our Eyes Closed, and the new album, Weather Vanes. I watched this movie twice now. Sam Jones, the director, seems to have this ability to walk into a recording situation and suddenly drama unfolds.
Yeah, and right. You start to wonder.
Is it planned ahead of time? How does that happen?
Did you not learn, Jason, from Jeff Tweedy and the Wilco doc that maybe...
I'm starting to think maybe Sam is just a very nefarious character, and he's super secretive about it. So when he comes into a situation that's going great, all of a sudden things start going wrong, and you don't see behind the scenes Sam going to each individual person and saying, hey, he said you suck. She said you suck. You know, he just knows when to start rolling, and he's really good at capturing that without making anybody feel like just a part of somebody else's narrative. Like, you know, everybody gets to be an individual character in Sam's movies. And I really appreciated that because, you know, hard things happen, but as long as you don't fall into that kind of rock and roll trope and just start plugging people in to move the narrative forward, I think you do a pretty good job of capturing it.
And I think the movie's incredibly powerful. And I think, you know, everybody comes out the better for it in terms of just the honesty that you were willing to show.
Courage.
And given the level of anxiety that was surrounding the Reunions album, which turned out to be a great piece of work, and in part maybe because of that, but how do you, you know, approaching your, you know, subsequent records, Weather Vanes in particular, being original music, similar to the way Reunions was, did that impact the way you approached going into the studio and interacting with the other musicians and people like Amanda, for example, your wife?
Yeah, probably so. I mean, on Weather Vanes, she and I didn't collaborate as much as we have in the past. She was super busy with her own record, Take It Like a Man, and she's also been recording an album on Bobby Nelson, who recently passed, Willie's sister. And that's a really beautiful piece of work. But there were a couple of times when I came to her in the writing process. But for the most part, I just sort of sat there and squeezed until it all came out of my own brain. You know, and I think we got there. It probably took me longer than it would have taken otherwise. But then on this recording, you know, I got a bunch of the basic tracks done and sort of made it a point to just have the people in the studio who needed to be in the studio that day and not make everybody show up and sit around and wait on everybody else. And then Amanda came in toward the end of the recording process and did a couple of days. So I think that worked better. But a lot of the issues that we're having with the reunions record, you know, those were things that weren't necessarily about making a record in the studio. They were, you know, just human growth type of things. There were things that we'd had to deal with from the beginning of our relationship that we finally got around to, or I finally got around to understanding and dealing with, and that made our whole process a whole lot easier. You know, I think when your work life and your, like, I don't know, other life are so closely connected, sometimes what looks like issues with, you know, creative differences is actually something completely different, just related to the relationships that you have, either with your partner or with your bandmates or whatever. And so, you know, after the documentary, I sort of made a conscious decision to try to be more proactive about those kind of things and change the way that we all communicate as a group and just really invest a lot of time into the way Amanda and I communicate. And, you know, I think if you make music with your friends, the problems that you solve, the interpersonal issues that you solve are things that you can resolve and get some kind of closure to. They find their way onto the stage and into the studio, and it just makes everything easier. So, yeah, Weather Vanes was a much easier album to make. And we had a lot of fun. Well, I've tried to open up my window and let the light come in. I step outside in the middle of the morning and in the evening again.
Jason, what was the decision to self-produce? The first time since 2011.
Yeah, I used to do it all the time. And then when I got sober, I thought I need to turn over some control. You know, that was one of the issues for me, the idea of controlling everything that was going on around me. And Dave Cobb was a really good person for that. You know, he was... It, clearly, it worked really well, and we may go back to working together at some point in the future. I felt like I could do it again without messing it up, you know? That was really all there was to it, because I enjoy that process. I really like it, and I had done it for some other people in the meantime, for Josh Ritter and Flying Boys of Alabama and just a few other things that I really kind of felt like this is something that's rewarding to me. And then when we did the Georgia Blue record, that was the thing that sort of put me over the top, because I thought, well, I can definitely handle this without going into the studio feeling like I have something to prove. And you know, when you do that, it interrupts your tastes as a producer.
The songs on this record, Weather Vanes, you know, Weather Vane, that, you know, which way is the wind blowing? A lot of songs about what's going on in the country, and it was very moving. You know, you were just coming out of COVID, or you were in the middle of COVID when the movie was being made, and you were struggling with that. And it seems like a lot of the issues that were sort of floating around there, just the total disruption of daily life in America and how we were approaching life in general, some of that seems to have bled over into the songs on this record in terms of the kind of stories you're telling.
Yeah, definitely. That's where my mind was at. And I'm always trying to document an emotional life. You know, when I make a record, I'm trying to make some, especially if it's a Jason Isbell and the 400 unit record. It's I think the point of that should be, where is my mind, you know? And that was still heavy on my mind at the time. I was still dealing with sort of the aftermath of all that and whatever the new normal is supposed to be. And then I just, you know, I spent a lot of time thinking about the reverberations of all that, you know, of the virus and the lockdown, and, you know, a lot of people were falling back into addiction. A lot of people weren't surviving, you know, even people that didn't die from the virus weren't surviving what the virus had done and had caused. And that was something that was very, you know, present and prescient to me.
As journalists, Greg and I have talked about this, we still don't think the stories have really come out about the total cost of those 2.5 years of hell.
No, and they never will. You know, we'll never know all of it, because we would like the narrative to be that we're over it and that it's going to be okay. And the less we look at it, the reality of it, the more okay it's going to be, which is frightening, because that means that we're not going to learn everything that we could from that process, you know.
We're in a period in America of not learning.
We're so good. We're so good at that, you know. We're a young country, but we sure have had a lot of lessons that have been taught to us and that we have taught ourselves. It's just that we would rather not pay much attention to those. We would rather just say, we're good. Let's just keep on going. Yeah. We've got the right idea.
I want to ask you about a song, Jason. As much as I've loved your entire catalog, I wasn't sure there would be a song ever again as powerful as What Have I Done to Help? And I think Miles, which closes Weather Vanes, is that song. Holy crap, brother.
Thank you. There's a mile between us, the boy.
I think, and this isn't an insult in any way, it starts out as a hybrid Neil Young, Crazy Horse, Cortez the Killer, and Southern Man, I think.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And then when you get to that part, you know, in Name of Survival, the last third, I mean, that's pure 400 unit. And I was wondering what you were going for in that epic, epic song.
Somewhere in the middle of recording that, we landed on Neil Young and Wings. You know, it's kind of like if Neil replaced Paul McCartney in Wings.
I love that.
Well, the multi-part thing a little bit.
That's maybe. the sort of thing a music critic writes and people say, what was he smoking?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's, you know, it has different movements, and it's sort of, that song's sort of a flash forward. It's one of those things where if we don't make those decisions and try to remain emotionally available to our family, to the people that we care about, what is the potential loss, you know? And that's what I was examining with that. Sometimes I move backwards in time, and sometimes I move forward with these songs. And I don't like to romanticize mistakes. A lot of songwriters do that, I think. It's an easy thing to do compared to actually playing out the tape. But it's a cautionary tale in some ways, but it's also it's a precautionary tale. That's what it is. And it's one of those things where, like, you know, Lennon would stop McCartney and say, hey, this is a song. This next part, that's another song. This part, that's also another song. Let's, you know, you got half of a record right here. You don't have one song. And then, you know, Ram and Man on the Run and everything was just like, this, you know, like side B of Abbey Road, just in perpetuity. Yeah. And I love those things about McCartney. I think that's a really cool move that he sort of invented in popular music. And it's something that I wanted to explore. It took a long time to get it right, but it was one of those things where we would just, you know, work and play the song and play the song and try to count and try to get every, and then when it would happen, every little breakthrough was celebrated in the studio, you know. Even the big cymbal crash at the end, they didn't have a gong. We were at Blackbird, and I was like, we got to have a gong. It's time.
You need a gong. Like, yeah.
You have to have a gong. This record, we did, there were a lot of firsts. You know, we had congas on this record on This Ain't It. That is a first. We have never brought in hand percussion like that, you know. And then, so we did that. The old rock and roll sort of cliches that I wanted to find a way to employ. And one of them was the gong, but they didn't have a gong. So we got what has to be the biggest ride cymbal in the world. It was like, I don't know, 90 inches or something. It was huge. It was so big that we put it in the reverb chamber, and they had one of those like square reverb chambers that goes, you know, all the way up 30, 40
feet. Oh, the
spring
reverb, yeah.
Yeah, the real reverb room, you know. And then they had mics coming down from the ceiling that you could adjust to get the size. Like, Blackbird's an incredible studio. They got a lot of stuff in there. But we put Chad in the reverb room with that cymbal, and he could barely stand, You know, he was like hiding in the corner because the cymbal took up the whole room. And of course, when he hit the crash, we had it turned up way too loud in the mix, and it was hilarious. Yeah. It was like an explosion. It was fun. It was a good challenge for us, and you know, the sort of bleakness of the lyrics was offset by how much of a good time we had recording that song. The hand turned the
page. Well, and a song like Miles 2, I think, also points out the, you know, the amazing chemistry that you have with these guys, the 400 unit. They've been co-billed on every album since 2009, I believe, right? Jason is in the 400 unit, 2009.
Well, except Southeastern.
Right. You know, it's interesting to me because, you know, it's not necessarily one of those things that you see all the time. Obviously, you're a songwriter in your own right, and you're a multi-instrumentalist, and you could probably work with an ad hoc group every time, but it seems like this was important for you to have this unit and able to develop this chemistry with them, and the diversity in the arrangements and the songwriting seems to, they're a big part of that. So was this always part of the plan? I want a band, you know, after you left the Drive-By Truckers, you wanted another band.
Yeah, that was my dream, you know. My dream was never to be alone on stage. And if you're a solo artist and, you know, you get a new band for every record or every tour, you use studio musicians, That's a fine thing to be, but that's somebody else's dream. You know, what I wanted to have was a rock and roll band. And when I joined the Truckers, you know, it was, you feel like you're in a gang. I mean, everybody gets to know each other way better than they want to. And, you know, when you're on stage, you can just tell how everybody's day is going. You don't have to ask. Mm. And the thing about a band like that is if one of us is not on our game, nobody will ever notice but us, you know, because the rest of us step in and lift, you know. Mm. And it's like a team in that way. It's you know, on stage it's valuable, but off stage it's just irreplaceable, because touring is isolating enough, you know. Even touring, like, it's funny, the more success you have as a touring artist, the more alone you are throughout your day. You know, you start out, everybody's in a van together, and then you're sleeping in somebody's living room together. And then you get a bus, and you got your bunk to go to, and then you get a couple of buses, and half the band's on one and half's on the other, and then you get another bus, and, you know, I have my own, and the band has theirs, and the crew has theirs, and, you know, if I'm touring with people that I don't actually care about hanging out with, I'm just going to be alone the whole time, and that's not what I want. I want to be out, you know, with a gang of my buddies, like Peter Pan or something, you know.
Yeah. I do know. I know exactly what you mean. That's part of it. You seem absolutely kind of surly to be playing the album release gig for reunions with just you and Amanda to an almost empty house in the documentary.
Yeah, that made me mad. Obviously, you know, I'm one of these people that I try to hold gratitude and anger in my mind at the same time. So I was very grateful to get to play those songs. It went better than I expected, as most things do. But, you know, I just craved that whole time, the horsepower, you know, being on stage with a drummer and a bass player and another guitar player and a keyboard player. And more than the crowd, I love the crowd. I'm thankful for them, but that's not the ultimate point. The thing that I really enjoy is steering the big, huge boat, you know. And it just, to have musicians of that caliber who are that invested in the songs that I made up, you know, is constantly rewarding to me. So during that time period, when we couldn't do that, that was the thing that really just broke my heart, you know, outside of the obvious casualties of all of it. I could still sit on the floor and play guitar all day. And, you know, I got really great guitars. I felt like the most successful retired dentist in the world, you know, because I've got all these old guitars and amps and, you know, but it's not what I signed up for. What I really love and what makes my heart grow is being up there and making a really loud noise with a bunch of people.
When we get back, Jason describes what it was like filming Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon in Oklahoma during the height of the pandemic. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. We'll take the copper from
the works at Me. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
And we are back. This week, we're talking with one of our favorite guests, Jason Isbell. Let's get right back into the conversation.
You'd mentioned that everybody knows what kind of day you had when you're in a band and a gang like that, and you go up on stage that night. When you're having a crappy day, you're on the road a lot, and then, you know, some days just aren't the greatest. You don't necessarily feel like being up there, or you're kind of weird about it, you know? What will another band member do to get you out of that? How do they get you out of it?
Oh, you come out, you know, you hang out with somebody, you walk over to them on stage and you make eye contact and you nod. Or if it's me, you know, I'll make their introduction a little extra that night. You know, I'll mention something about them or tell a story. But it really, it's a matter of just like breaking through that wall that naturally happens when you're on stage and you're not in the moment. You're trying not to mess up rather than just allowing yourself to create. And sometimes it can be simple as somebody coming over and, you know, nudging you with their shoulder and nodding their head like you're doing a good job and this is fun. We like our job, don't we? You know, it's that kind of thing. I think all of us, if we're having a hard day and we're struggling when we're on tour, you know, we're looking forward to that moment where we can get on stage, because that's something that really takes everything else out of the equation. You know, unless it's something just terrible, unless somebody that you care about passed away and you're out on tour and can't be there or something, it's, you know, those things aren't really fixable, but a rock and roll show will do a lot of good for you.
Bound for glory and grown to die. Oh, Jason, I've seen this quote pop up in a few of your interviews. You haven't started the whole press cycle yet for Weather Vanes, but it seems like you've been ruminating on this idea of nostalgia. And I always flash back when I was 22, I got to tour with Wire. And they were touring America for the first time, but not playing any of the three albums worth of Wire songs people loved. Because in a pretentious British art punk way, but they were right, they said, nostalgia is the kiss of death for all great art, Jim. We move forward, we don't move backwards.
And
you've been putting it as nostalgia is an abomination, it's a crime, it's unnatural. That quote was in relation to cast iron skillet, but it seems to be something you've been ruminating on for a while now, a couple of years, not looking backward through rose-colored glasses.
Yeah, I think it's one of those sort of accidents of privilege, you know, because when we were all in the caves, we didn't really have the time or the energy to think about yesterday. We had to go find something to eat.
And to stay away from the saber-toothed tiger.
Exactly. Secure our possessions and try to move forward. And the way we would look, I'm assuming, I wasn't around, but I'm assuming the way we would look into the past is, you know, by saying things like, well, yesterday the saber-toothed tiger was over there, so I think I'm going to go to a different place, you know. I'm going to draw pictures of these animals on the wall so I can remember where they were, because I either need to kill them or avoid them, you know. And the thing about nostalgia to me is it's none of us are really capable of seeing any perspective other than our own. You know, not fully. Some are better at it than others, but none of us can really fully know what yesterday looked like from somebody else's point of view. And I think any time you go into that nostalgic place where you're romanticizing your view of the past or your version of the past, you're being inconsiderate to the other people who were there. And, you know, when you look at pictures of your kids when they were babies on your phone, this physically hurts. This feels weird to me. It feels like I'm eating something that I'm not supposed to be eating. Because I think that as we get older, you know, we're supposed to get uglier. And your parents are supposed to look at you and think, oh, wow, get that disgusting thing out of my house. Right about the time when you're 13, 14 years old, when you're supposed to be getting out of the house and learning how to do things for yourself. And we look at the pictures, and our mind tells us, you know, this is my child. But it's not. That's not your child. Your child is this gangly 13-year-old that hates your guts, you know, every waking second of the day. That was your child at one point. But if you keep thinking of that as your child, the natural progression is not going to happen. And I think that works on a personal level, too. I think if you keep thinking of the past through the lens of only your perspective, you're never going to understand it. You're never going to learn from it. And and you're just going to pine for it. And it's impossible. I think, you know, now I'm going to play Cover Me Up every night because I like the present moment of people singing along with it, you know. And I feel like the songs are kind of like, you know, they're tools that I carry with me. Once I've written them, I sort of put them in the tool belt and I can break them out when I need to, you know. But that being said, you know, nostalgia, I think, is a lie just because it's not taking into consideration any perspective other than your own. And then your own perspective is skewed by the concept of you surviving that. There's just no way to see it with any kind of reality.
Well, and also you're not truly enjoying the present.
Yeah,
if you're
right.
Forever living in the past.
There's that. Yeah. You know, I mean, we're all going to have problems, but I think if you have the same problems now that you had 10 years ago, you're probably not doing the best job of moving forward, you know. The box of problems stays full, but it should be completely remodeled, you know, from time to time.
At least have new problems, yeah.
At least have new problems. There's a T-shirt, yeah. Yeah, well, I used to say, for a while, I would say, I am ready for some new problems when we're on tour, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's got to feel weird to be, I mean, well, I don't know, weird, probably great that it's sort of somewhat normal now. You know, you're able to go back on the road and you play the music. And I'm just curious, like this period of time that we just went through that you've sort of, it filters into the songs. What's your perspective on your job, your career, your future after all that experience? What have you learned from that if anything?
I see more value in it now than I did before, because it's more than just a court gesture, you know, and it's more, I think, than distraction. That's something that I realized when we first started going back out and playing. You know, we would be playing on a Tuesday or a Wednesday night somewhere, and the crowd would be reacting like it was a Saturday, just because they were so grateful, you know, that we could do that again, we could gather again. I think if it's done right, the live music experience, just like the recorded music experience, can be something that reminds people of what we have in common. And I think the better songwriters are the ones who find those unexpected details, the things that make the listener think, you know, how does he know that, or how does she know that about me, that I thought I was alone in that, you know, in that suffering or that secret. I thought that was something that made me different from everybody else. And now, all of a sudden, you know, that I hear Joni Mitchell or Randy Newman or somebody talk about it, I think, well, I'm not different from that person, so there's got to be more of us out there. And I think, you know, after doing it for that many years up until the pandemic, you sometimes can start to feel like you're just entertainment, or you're just there to take people's minds off of their everyday lives. Now I realize that's not true. That's not why we're there. We're there to remind people that they're not alone. And after spending so much time alone, I think a lot of us really need that.
That's well said. I love the line. There's a couple of lines you say in the movie that really stuck with me, and just related to that, there's only one story, you said. Will you listen to what my life is like, and let's compare?
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed, you know, and I think what people appreciate is that you're being so brutally honest about yourself. Because even when the song isn't ostensibly about you, I hear part of your life in those songs. And that honesty is what they relate to, you know?
Yeah, that's my currency, you know? I mean, there are better guitar players than me on the street that I live on, you know? And there are better songwriters than me within a five-mile radius of here. You know, I'm in Nashville, Tennessee. You can't around, you know? But my currency is my story. And the more of that I use in the songs, the more valuable the songs are going to be. When you have the goal that I have, I mean, my goal is not to be as widely consumed as possible. Some people have that goal, and that's fine. And if you're going to do that, you better keep it light. Talk about dancing, you know. But the goal for me is not that. The goal for me is to try to move people and connect people. So that honesty is really, that's all I have that's of great value. And you take it and you sort of forge it into something that rhymes and something that releases some serotonin and put some chords under it that sort of suspend the tension and release it at the right time. And there you go. You're off.
Are you looking for something easy? Do you need to feel alive? Do you crave a love that tears through your life like a Category 5?
And it seems to me, Jason, that Nashville still doesn't know what to make of you or Amanda, for that matter.
Yeah.
I just read a blurb, you know, one of those news shorts in one of the country magazines, Jason Isbell's Weather Vane's coming June, whatever, right? You know, country music's alpha male, Jason Isbell, releases his new album.
Is that what it said?
And wow. That's what it said. That's what it said. And I still am like, what's an alpha male? Right? And then also, but don't call him country. And I'm like, what the hell? It's like I'm reading ancient Greek. I don't understand that.
Wow. Yeah, they got music right, and most likely they got
and your name.
Male. Yeah, they got male is probably right, you know, unless something happens. I think I'm stuck with this gender, but yeah, that's interesting. You know, I saw like a review of the Scorsese movie yesterday that said Southern rocker. And I was like, well, that's close, but you
from
know,
all Alabama,
these things,
right?
Yeah, these things that carry their own context and their own weight, and they become shorthand for something. And, you know, it's really hard to use shorthand to describe some people in their work. And I like that. I want to keep it that way. You know, yeah. My goal is it should take you 5 minutes to explain to somebody what it is that I do. You know, if not, yeah. then I'm not doing something yeah. weird enough, you know. And that's really like, I love really weird left of the dial independent music. And I can't really make it myself that sounds like that, because that's just not the type of musician that I am. And that's not the type of band that I have. And I think maybe our way of being weird is by making it difficult to pin down what genre of music we make.
Well, and I also think you're outspoken. You know,
yeah.
when you see wrong, you speak out about it. And that's not how, you know, the pop star, and there are plenty of them coming out of Nashville,
yeah.
thinks, you know, they don't want to offend any potential consumer ever.
Right, right, right. And they've got, you know, they're basically divided up into shares, you know, and they have shareholders to please, yeah. you know, quote unquote. And I don't have that, you know. I'm super lucky that 10 years ago we started our little label and, you know, found a good label services company that did all the ground legwork for it. And now I own my work, you know, so mm-hmm. I'm not really too concerned. Like, nobody's breathing down my neck or yelling at me all the time to shut up or make a new record or whatever. You know, I don't have any bosses other than my wife, you know, and every once in a while my daughter. But
yeah, you're underestimating Mercy. We saw yeah. her in that. The real stars of the documentary are not you or Amanda. It's Mercy and the chickens.
Yeah, right.
Because chickens steal the show.
I know. It's true. You know, those are the only people that I answer to. Mercy and the chickens.
yeah.
That's it, you know. That's it.
There's an album title. Mercy yeah. and the Chickens.
Mercy and the Chickens. Yeah. I left my wallet in the hotel room. They barely let me on the plane. I didn't get a chance to check the news. Somebody shot up a classroom again.
You mentioned uncategorizable. I think that's appropriate. This record, I think there's a lot of stories in this record. There's stories. You're in there, but there's also stories about America. I think this is about America now. And in that respect, it reminds me a little bit of how bleak the time was when Springsteen released Nebraska. I compare this record to that one in terms of just the tone of it and the way it sort of is expansive in the way it looks at the world, the country specifically. What was their point where you knew you had an album? Like, okay, I got this song, and this is going to be a song I can build an album around. Did you think that way when you were putting this record together?
Yeah, I mean, I started writing songs in Oklahoma when I was working on the Scorsese movie, because I had so much downtime. The acting job is wow. I thought we did a lot of hurry up and wait, but that is a next level. You know, we spent a lot of days in hair and makeup and costumes waiting on a storm to pass. And I guess if you film outdoors in Oklahoma, that's going to happen. But, you know, we had a great deal of time, and I started writing those songs out there. And, you know, I was in the middle of working on something that was this really broad, realistic look at America, and, you know, in a slightly earlier stage, but, you know, a lot of the problems that we were having then are the same problems that we're having now, and just different versions of those. And, you know, I don't know if this experiment's going to work out or not. You know, we seemed so confident 100 years ago, but I just don't know now. And that's just where my head was. And when I started writing those songs, I was thinking about the people in those little small towns in Oklahoma where we were hanging out. And there was such a sort of, you know, really interesting contrast, almost like an anachronism, like if you made like a TV show where you took all like these extremely famous movie stars and dropped them off in a small town in the middle of Oklahoma. That's sort of what was going on, you know, because it's like Leonardo DiCaprio was going to Walmart four or five yeah, times yeah. a week. Because I asked him, I was like, what do you do here? You know? And he said, I go to Walmart. He said, that place is amazing. You know, he had his He had his mask on and you know, his hat down low, and he would just go in there and look at stuff. And the people in Oklahoma didn't have any idea that that's who was standing behind him, you know, with a bag of charcoal or something. that got old pretty quick. The next time I asked him, he'd had enough of Walmart. But, you know, it was this really interesting thing because I was meeting people out there. You know, the time that I wasn't on set, I was meeting local people, and I met a family from Beijing who had been hired to work for Philips. And you know, they were engineers, and young Chinese couple with a little, like a 4-year-old, 5-year-old son. And they had come from Beijing to Bartlesville, Oklahoma. And they were, you know, in the house across the street from us. And Mercy and I went over and had dinner with them one night, you know, and their dinner table was a folding table. They brought in a folding table, you know, and they were embarrassed and everything. And I was like, listen, you guys are young and you're starting out and you're in Oklahoma and you're used to this, you know, glass skyscrapers and all these things to look at and all these people everywhere all the time. And now you're out here in the middle of nowhere. Take your time, you know, getting your house set up like you want it. Don't worry about us, you know. But one thing I asked the lady, the young Chinese woman, you know, I said, we hear all these things about China all the time that are you know, mostly negative because the climate right now, and this was, you know, in the dead center of the pandemic, so they weren't, some people were not treating them well at that point in time.
And that's before the balloons, too.
Yes, it was before the balloons, And I said, we hear all these terrible things about China, but what is something that you miss, you know? Because I'd like to hear, you know, something that you think you liked about being over there that's not the same here. And she said, when something was wrong, there was always somebody that you could tell. And, you know, if you bought something and you paid too much for it, somebody conned you out of your money, you could go to somebody in the government and you could say, this happened to me and this was wrong. And more often than not, if you were lucky, they would do something about it. And she said, in this country, you're on your own. You know, if somebody talks you out of your life savings, it's just gone. You know, and I thought, yeah, welcome to America, you know, land of the free to do just about whatever, you know, but that stuff was all right here. You know, constantly I was thinking about that, about how, you know, our country does so many things right and so many things so terribly, terribly wrong. You know, I mean, I don't want to live in communist China, but at the same time, you know, it shouldn't be every man for himself.
No, and if you feel like putting on a dress and going on stage at one of those cafes tonight in Nashville, you can't.
Can't
How
do
absurd
it.
How absurd is that?
Yeah, it is absurd. It's just, they just want to make the people that disagree with them, they would like for them to not exist. It's like, if at all possible, I would like to make you not exist. And how do we get to that? You know, let's find something about you that we can get everybody else riled up about so much that you'll stop being yourself. And eventually you'll just be another consumer. And you won't keep talking about how you feel and what you want and what you need and other people and all this that gets in our way when we're trying to get more power. And I think that's at the heart of it. But it just is so hurtful for so many people. And, you know, I mean, talking about people who are non-binary or trans people, like, we've been making fun of those people a long, long time. We've been giving them the short end of the stick for a long, long time. And for somebody to continue to pile on, you know, because they can use that as a maneuver now, it's just really disgusting to me. It's like, how about we, I don't know, maybe try to be nicer to these folks that we've just stoned for generations.
Yeah. Or just ignore them if you want to. But
hey, sometimes that's the nicest thing you can do. Just leave everybody the hell alone, you know.
I love the revelation, Jason, too, about the chubby kid in his bedroom playing guitar. I mean, that was me
in
my basement playing drums. I never got picked for no sport team. I had no date in all through high school. It was, it was, what did we do? We learned how to play.
Yeah. And I'm grateful for that. You know, I'm glad that I wasn't one of the cool kids in school, because that doesn't last very long, you know. And the stuff that you learn by not being one of the cool kids, that can get you a long way in the adult world, you know, whether it's whether it's playing the guitar or coding or writing or whatever. You know, those things that if you can develop the ability to sit with yourself for long hours and solve puzzles, man, you got a good chance at making something of yourself.
Oh, did you ever love a woman with a death wish? Something in her eyes like flipping off a light switch. Everybody dies, but you gotta find a reason to carry on. We have been talking with Jason Isbell. It's always a pleasure, Jason. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, guys. I always appreciate talking to y'all.
Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we have a fascinating conversation with Lisa Cortez, the director of a great new documentary about Little Richard, one of the founders of rock and roll. And don't forget to listen to our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
Good stuff on there always. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our social media consultant is Katie Cott.